for antiwar.com and Chaos Radio 95.9 FM in Austin, Texas. I'm Scott Horton, and this is Anti-War Radio. Despite all the pressure from the people of this country and even powerful segments of the American establishment, the White House insists that American forces cannot leave Iraq until their new army is trained and prepared to vanquish enemies within and without. There are some problems with that, and to help explain at least one angle on the situation is Martin Smith. Worked for 30 years at ABC News, 24 years producing for PBS Frontline. And there's a new project at PBS called America at a Crossroads, and one segment of that is his new documentary for Frontline, Gangs of Iraq. I haven't had a chance to see it yet, but I was lucky enough to read the Salon.com interview review, so I guess I have a basic flavor for what the show is about. I guess basically the problem is the new Iraqi army that American forces are training are basically, for the most part, members of the various Shiite sectarian militias. Is that right?
Well, first of all, it's important to understand that the centerpiece of our strategy in Iraq has been to stand up the forces so that we can withdraw. It's not that we don't have a strategy. It's that the strategy that we have has so far not worked. And that is because it is very difficult, some people would say impossible, to construct an army and a police force in the midst of what is essentially a civil war. It's something like going into Kentucky during the American Civil War and thinking that you could form a nonpartisan force by recruiting people from Georgia and people from Pennsylvania and making some kind of sense of a force that would be somehow neutral. In fact, in the case of Iraq, once the elections took place in 2005, once the elections took place in January of 2005, and the Shia population were the overwhelming winners, the various ministries, especially the Ministry of the Interior, were taken over by people with affiliation with one of the major religious parties, Shia religious parties, and you began to see Sunnis being fired from the ministry. This is the ministry that controls all of Iraq's police, and people installed in high-level positions that had loyalty to or former experience in militias.
And now you say in the Salon.com article that entire divisions, basically, of the Badr Brigades, the Badr Corps of the Supreme Council for Islamic Revolution in Iraq, just literally came in as the Badr Corps and became the new police department in some places.
There are numerous reports of this, and we saw on the ground what it means, and certainly talked to a lot of commanders, and as well as the Prime Minister Maliki, who owes his position to Muqtada al-Sadr, one of the who commands the Mehdi army, another Shia militia.
Now, is it that the Mahdi army is infiltrating or joining the government forces to a greater degree than the Badr Corps, or about equally, as far as you can tell?
Well, the Badr Corps has taken over leadership positions. The Mehdi army, those people that have sympathies with the Mehdi army are more likely the rank and file within the police forces or the army. There's a kind of class differential between the two groups. The Badr Corps, too, has a history that's a bit different than the Mehdi army. The Mehdi army is a homegrown movement with not a lot of hierarchical control. Sadr himself does not pull all the strings. There are many commanders within the Mehdi army. It's more of a grassroots movement.
Mm-hmm.
The Badr Corps was formed and fought from Iran and received official Iranian support for many years while Saddam was in power. And they came back into Iraq after the U.S. invasion. And that's a group that is, in some regards, looked down upon by the Mehdi army, which is a homegrown movement of people who withstood and endured the oppression of Saddam. So there's a distinction there. But in many cases, both of these militia groups have infiltrated into police and army units. And beyond that, it's beyond simply whole units infiltrating. It's a matter of sympathies. Again, it's like these people have allegiances that are not to a national entity, but to a sectarian identity.
Right, and really that's the question, or even maybe a national identity. I know the Ayatollah Khomeini created the Supreme Council for Islamic Revolution, or suggested the creation of it. And
he certainly supported it. It was under Muhammad al-Hakim, and now under the control of his brother. Muhammad was assassinated by Sunni insurgents, but now it's under the control of his brother.
And so what does it mean to you when you see Abdulaziz Hakim, the new head of SCIRI, meeting in the White House in the Oval Office with George Bush while they together denounce Muqtada al-Sadr? As far as I know, and maybe you can help me out, it doesn't seem like the Mahdi Army is any more or less of an evil death squad than the Badr Corps is. Why is America siding with the Iran-backed faction instead of the nationalist?
From the beginning, Abdulaziz al-Hakim had sided with the coalition. He represents the Shia establishment, if you will, the more middle and elite classes, and they had associated themselves with the coalition, had not directly opposed the coalition. They saw great advantage to Saddam leaving, and they allied themselves with the Americans, who were going to help them through democratic means gain power in Iraq. Muqtada al-Sadr, on the other hand, denounced the coalition and denounced the occupation from the very get-go, and skirmished with and killed U.S. soldiers very early on. There was an arrest warrant out for him for having assassinated a rival Shia cleric. Sadr is therefore different than Hakim in the view of the White House. On the other hand, both groups have been involved in killings and torture, illegal torture of the of Sunni civilians that have been captured.
Isn't that funny? We have to distinguish illegal torture from legal torture nowadays,
well, that's
don't
a
we?
Well, I'm misspeaking to say that. I mean,
I know, I'm just joking.
Right.
No, but your point is that here we have these two groups, one of them backed by Iran, one of them local, homegrown, and America's siding with the Iran-backed faction because they're being nice to us, whereas the nationalists want us gone. And so,
right. Well, I mean, we didn't have a lot of choice. I mean, this was not—it was not easy for the Americans to side with Sadr, although they never began negotiations with him. They sidelined him from the beginning. Does he have legitimacy? Well, sure. But he was...
Well, and he's an elected part of the government now.
And he is, of course, part of the government now. And the Prime Minister Maliki, his power... I mean, he gained the Prime Minister position because of the support from Sadr. So it makes a very difficult and complicated sort of three-dimensional chess game. Does Maliki turn on the Mahdi army? Does he turn on Sadr? Well, it's not easy for him to do. The thing that people need to understand is that the militias are not just these sort of gangs operating outside the law. Every political party in Iraq at one time has had a militia. And, of course, the SCIRI has its Badr Corps today. Sadr, who is, as you say, has power in parliament, has his seats in parliament, has his Mehdi army. So these are...
Well, and in fact, Maliki is from the Dawa Party, which really doesn't have much of a militia, and so he relies on kind of trying to split the difference between SCIRI and Sadr's guys, right?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, the Dawa Party had its militia. Their strength as a armed force has dwindled. But yes, Bremer came in 2003 and said right away, look, we can't have a functioning state unless the state has a monopoly on the use of force. Well, they still don't have a monopoly on the use of force. It's split between the Badr Corps, the Sunni insurgent groups, and there are many of them, the Mehdi army, and a variety of criminal gangs of sorts. The latest count is that there are some 28 different militias operating in Iraq. That's what we call our program that's airing in April on Frontline, Gangs of Iraq. It's helps people get a grip on just what we're facing there.
Right. It seems like the longer we stay, the less and less of a monopoly there is, the more of these groups spring up.
You're absolutely right. I mean, what's happening is, as somebody called it, the atomization. You know, a increasing number of these militias. I mean, when I was there last in December, I was told they were the coalition, the U.S. military were monitoring 23 separate militias. The latest count is 28.
And now a lot of what's going on that we read about is pretty severe ethnic cleansing in Baghdad. I know the Times in England showed a map of which neighborhoods used to be Shiite and are now Sunni, and used to be Sunni and are now Shiite, and there seems to be a real big push. This is, again, not an ethnic difference at all, right? We're talking all about Arabs here, this religious difference, they're fighting over who's going to have a monopoly on control of Baghdad.
Yeah, I guess you can understand it as, you know, a kind of Protestants versus Catholics, Shia versus Sunni.
They're having their 30 years war now.
They're having their 30 years war now, and the difference between these sects goes back 1,300 years, and it's over an argument about the succession and who is the authority.
Let me pose a question to you that I talked a little bit with my guest Juan Cole about yesterday, and that is the idea that this sectarian civil war that's taking place in Iraq is, in a sense, a misinterpretation. That what's really happening here is there's sort of a proxy war taking place between Iran and Saudi Arabia, and it's happening in Iraq. What do you think about that?
Well, I think there's a lot of truth to that, and I think I would put it more that's what's developing, that's what's on the horizon, because as you see, if you're sitting in Saudi Arabia or sitting in Iran and you see your folks losing in Iraq, you come in with reinforcements, and that is what we're looking at. As the Sunni insurgents continue to be able to run their bombs into Shia marketplaces, the Iranians get more concerned about and look for ways to support the Shia establishment and militia, and vice versa. When the Sunni world sees the death squads operating out of the Ministry of the Interior in Baghdad, they need the field, they need to shore up somehow the insurgency and put more money into those bombs that we see going off every day.
Now, those bombs that we see going off every day, TV says that it's Iran that's supplying all those bombs to the Sunni insurgency. What about that?
I have never, as I understand it, it's not that way at all. As I understand it, the Sunnis are using bombs, car bombs, suicide bombers, to run them into Shia neighborhoods and marketplaces and police recruiting stations and blowing people up. The Iranians are supporting militia activity that goes after Sunni insurgents or indeed goes after civilians in many cases.
Now, can this accurately be traced back to what we heard about, you know, I guess it was maybe late 2004, the beginning of 2005, the idea that we would go with the El Salvador option, and that was basically to deliberately create Shiite death squads to go after the Sunnis. The rhetoric at the time was, well, we need people who are locals who can get that good intelligence and help root out the real ringleaders of the bad guys. Is that where this came from?
You know, I've heard these things too, and I haven't been able in my reporting to establish any truth in that. General David Petraeus, who's now been in the news because he's now in charge of these new tactics that they're trying out in Baghdad, he was at that time that you're speaking of, in 2004, 2005, in charge of army and police training and responsible for the monitoring of what was going on inside the army and inside the police. And we interview him in the program. He says that he had a very difficult time running down who was responsible for all the violence. There's no doubt, however, that within the Ministry of the Interior and the police department, these things were happening under his watch.
I am Scott Horton. This is Anti-War Radio, and I'm talking with Martin Smith, producer for PBS Frontline. And we're talking about his new one, which will not be coming out actually until April, called Gangs of Iraq. This ethnic violence is just spiraling completely out of control. And I guess I wonder whether you buy the basic premise of the war party, which is that American forces there are preventing this from being worse.
Well, I don't know about that. You know, I was there on Thanksgiving Day, in a day where 200 people died from two or three Sunni car bombs. And then I was sitting in a police station in a Sunni neighborhood, and the mortars started flying out of Sadr City in retaliation for these bombing attacks. I don't know that the American presence prevented any more of these mortar attacks from taking place, or prevented any of the bomb. I mean, I don't know how much worse it would be if we weren't there. I didn't see us out there preventing. We weren't running roadblocks. We weren't in Sadr City. Our presence, I mean, I was riding around with troops on that day in those neighborhoods as this was going on, and I didn't see us preventing anything. You know, that's an unknown as to what would happen when we pull out.
Is it true what I read, that the security situation in Baghdad is so bad that really you can't go out into Iraq without members of the U.S. Army accompanying you?
We did go into the red zone, as they say, without protection, but it's an extremely risky thing to do. We did it on a few occasions, but you put yourself at great risk. Everybody uses some kind of security service. If they're not embedded with the U.S. forces, they're going to be with some kind of private security detail, private contractors providing, you know, hard shell vehicles. It's almost, you know, for somebody who's not Arab or appears to be Arab, it's extremely risky to spend any time outside of the green zone.
I read an article just last week where they said they were basically describing the restrictions, or the restrictive conditions, I guess I should say, at one of the hotels in the green zone where some of the foreign reporters are staying, and that there was one young lady, a reporter from Europe, who decided she just couldn't take it anymore and she was going to rebel at the rules and go ahead out on her own, and she got in a cab and was never seen again.
That doesn't surprise me in the least. When we were out in a soft shell car, a car without bulletproof glass or armor, we saw police, people that looked like police, at least. I don't know who they were. People ride around in police vehicles. Sometimes they don't have uniforms. Sometimes they do. They set up impromptu roadblocks. They point their weapons at you. You don't know what you're facing. It's a very murky, confused, chaotic situation.
One of the things that is brought up in your interview with Salon.com is some footage that you have of a training camp. Some footage that you have of a training camp in Jordan, where the trainers are attempting to indoctrinate the soldiers in Iraqi nationalism, and that it's just not quite taking. Can you describe the scene for us?
There's a guy named Rick Bartle who is a private contractor who is there at the, or was there when we filmed there a few months back, at the training center in Jordan. This is a large facility that trains the Iraqi police. And he is a self-described motivational speaker giving a pep talk in the way that maybe a high school football coach would to a bunch of Iraqi recruits. And this is one of their first indoctrination classes, and he has them pledging allegiance to the Iraqi flag and chanting freedom and other things. And it's embarrassing at best to watch this. And, you know, it's
perhaps worthy a note that this is happening in Jordan, not even in Iraq.
They wanted to build a police training academy in Iraq, but they couldn't get contractors like Rick Bartle or contractors from around the world or police trainers to come into Iraq. It's just it was not safe. So they built the facility there in Jordan. It's just another indication of how unstable and how out of control things are.
Well, Zbigniew Brzezinski and William Odom and other very powerful, influential voices like these have referred to the invasion of Iraq as a major strategic disaster in and of itself where it stands now. But I'd like to go ahead and, if it's all right with you, ask you to do a little speculating about what might happen if America bombs Iran. It's been told that Abdulaziz Aqim, the head of the Supreme Council for Islamic Revolution, which, as you said, comes from Iran, that he was asked point blank, what would the Supreme Council and its Badr Corps do if America attacked Iran? And his answer was, we will do our duty. It's been reported anyway. And so it got me thinking about, I guess it was right around a year ago this time, Khalilzad was working really hard, I think, to try to switch sides back to the Baathists and get our guys behind Sunni lines. I wonder if you perceive, a disaster for our troops surrounded by Shiites in Iraq if a war against Iran is to begin shortly.
Well, I've spoken with General Petraeus, who's now in charge of our strategy there. His idea is that we need to neither support Shia or Sunni. And so, as I understand it, we're going to be one more gang on the street, but trying to referee a civil war by cordoning off neighborhoods in Baghdad and trying to quell the violence. Yes, there have been a number of. We have been seen to be supporting the Shia because we supported the elected government. But when that elected government did not respect minority rights, it became a problem. So then there was talk by Khalilzad, the ambassador, of moving more support over to the Sunni side of the equation. As I understand it, we're now engaged in trying to do neither of those things, to be a neutral player as much as that's possible. It's a very difficult thing to do. The other thing I'll say about this whole new, what they're calling new strategy, I have to call it just simply new tactics, because the strategy remains, as we focus on in the documentary, it's about training troops and getting ourselves out of there. It's training Iraqi troops so we can stand down. What they're doing with these new tactics in Baghdad is to try to cordon off and control, hold certain neighborhoods. Question I have is what happens at the periphery of those neighborhoods. Let's say the Mahdi army moves out of the area that we're securing. They still have the periphery they can peck away at. And so if our effort isn't larger, it's hard to imagine how the violence is going to subside.
Yeah, they're only talking really about reinforcing troop levels in Baghdad and in Al-Anbar province.
In a few neighborhoods only.
And even then, just small portions of that. And of course, we're talking about guerrilla fighters, and here they've had, 2.5 months of prior warning that this surge is coming. Doesn't that just mean they'll put their rifle in the basement and drop out of the militia for a month or two and then join later?
That's exactly right. They'll just fade away and they'll come back. They have, the home court advantage here. They know we're not going to be there forever, and they stick around long enough, they'll be declaring victory. What they'll face is still their adversaries within Iraq. They've still got a country that was created at the stroke of a pen back in the 20s, that isn't a real nation, so to speak. It's made up of Kurds, Shias, and Sunnis, and until those differences are resolved, it's like one sergeant told me when I was on a base there. He says, I kind of think people have a right to have their own civil war without other people butting in on it.
Right, yeah, imagine how we'd have felt if the British and the French and the Russians had created a peacekeeping force to come in and intervene in our history like that.
I think that's worth thinking about. And the problem has been that the longer we've stayed there, the more of these gangs that seem to pop up, more of these militias. So the problem has spiraled more and more out of control.
Well, and that's really what these people are fighting over. It's not just, you know, you're an infidel and so I'll put a drill in your head. They're fighting over who's going to control the new central state here. That's really the crux of this, is that we've basically said we don't care who runs it, but somebody's going to control a single monopoly on force over Kurdistan, the Shiite area in the south, and the Sunni triangle. Somebody's going to, and so they're fighting like hell over who's going to be those guys.
And as long as, I mean, and I think it was the hope of the, I mean, it was clearly the hope of the Bush administration that they would do this fighting verbally in a parliament. But because militias, because these gangs, if you will, were never dismantled, were never incorporated within the legitimate national police and army, you have arguing going on in the parliament that is mirrored by arguments between militias out on the streets, because these militias exist. I mean, they are politics by other means.
Right. Well, if it's all right, in the last couple of minutes here, I'd like to change the subject. I can see from your bio here, you've done a lot of work on Afghanistan and even on hunting Osama bin Laden. So I'd like to ask you briefly, do you think bin Laden is in Waziristan, which I guess is the conventional wisdom, and is he impossible to capture or what?
Well, first of all, I don't think it'll make much difference if they do capture him. I mean, it'll make a difference for a few days, and but I don't think Al-Qaeda as a hierarchical organization exists in such a way that it did in 2001. So taking bin Laden down is like taking down a leader of a movement, but that movement still has its followers, and I don't think that they're taking direct orders from a bin Laden.
In that sense, it might be a detriment to the terror war if the symbol of all evil for the American people is removed. Might be harder to continue the war against the rest of the people who've been radicalized to his cause since September 11th.
Well, I don't know. I don't know that... look, the guy is deemed a criminal and is responsible for terrorist acts against the United States. I mean, it makes sense for us to go after him, and it will make some difference in some quarters. But the real question is, how do you decide to prevent terrorist acts in the future? And I think the debate that's going to happen in the future is over whether or not we put ourselves into these countries like Afghanistan and Iraq with a large footprint, with large bases, and try to construct new nations, or do we do a better job of police work around the world and at our borders and rely on that to prevent terrorist attacks? The problem with these large bases and these large presence and these efforts at nation building is that we are creating, as military commanders have told me, as many enemies as we're making enemies as we do it. That these guerrilla campaigns, these insurgencies, have a long life, and it's not easy for us, it may be next to impossible for us to actually transform any of these countries in our own image. And this is what the military commanders believe. So I think that's the debate that has to happen as to what the right approach to this is.
Martin Smith, he's a producer for Frontline on PBS and runs Rain Media, available at rainmedia.net. Gangs of Iraq will be airing in April. I'm sorry, do you know the date in April this is going to run?
April 17th on Frontline.
April 17th on Frontline, Gangs of Iraq by Martin Smith. Thank you very much for your time today, sir.
Thank you.